We've been considering Yahweh's perspective on his Torah, prophets, and Psalms, his teaching, his instructions, his guidance, so that when we return to the poison pen that is Paul, we would understand how Yahweh and Paul are in irreconcilable conflict. And we have our good friend Kirk is with us here, who I think he has an opening comment about Paul and Mohammed, which you would normally think as strange bedfellows, but they indeed had a lot in common. Hi, Kirk.
Good morning. I can't separate the two. I can build a case that Muhammad is a really horrible, you know, thing, but then he kills your body. But the worst that Muhammad could do to me is he could kill my body. He could torture me, and it'd be a horrible death, and I'd scream and holler. But that's the worst he can do to me. The trouble with Paul, he is exactly the same, only he, well, first of all, they're both liars. They're both sheep thugs and robbers and killers.
Right.
Muhammad kills people. Paul kills souls.
Right.
And when you add up which is the worse, Paul wins.
I think Paul's worse than Muhammad.
Well, I mean,
too.
What could be worse than killing your soul?
Yeah, but you know, if you look at it, Muhammad began as a weasel, as an incompetent man. He wasn't aggressive. He wasn't violent initially. He was just a weasel. He was a self-righteous weasel, perpetrating a scam for his own personal benefit. And that was how he began. Paul, by his own admission, was a thug. He was murderous. And so Muhammad became what Paul's began as.
Yeah,
both men acknowledged that they were demon-possessed. Paul in 2 Corinthians, Muhammad both during his experience with the demented spirit in his
Ramadan,
first revelation. And then, the first experience during Ramadan, and then in his farewell sermon, he acknowledged that a demon had been permanently attached to him. So both men admitted to being demon-possessed. Both men created gods in wholesale opposition to Yahweh. Both men claimed that their testimony confirmed that which their every word reputed.
Mm-hmm. And they're both failures.
Complete and utter failures. One was a failed rabbi. The other was a failed merchant. If you were to compare which is worse, Paul or Muhammad, I view Paul worse as well, and for a number of reasons. One is far more people have lost their soul, have died a spiritual death. Their soul died estranged from Yahweh because of Paul. So Paul's had a more overwhelming consequence on humankind. And also because Muhammad's Quran recital, Muhammad's proposal was so awesomely stupid, just so utterly insane, that you really have no one to blame but yourself if you become a Muslim. And it, like this little girl that became a Muslim was going to go off, leave Denver and go fight for the Islamic State. She's an idiot. Anyone who accepts Islam is an utter fool. The Quran is the worst book ever written. Muhammad is an absolute, total, and complete moron. Now, while it's obvious that Paul was insane, and he admits that he's insane, and while it's obvious that Paul's testimony is completely contradictory of the very God that he claims inspired him, which is rationally impossible, the rhetoric of Paul, for those who are not thinking, for those who are not logical and rational, can easily be beguiling. And so, it's a case of you got no one to blame but yourself if you become a Muslim, if you believe that Allah rewards those who kill for him. But, you know, one of the things that's also common among them, so I think Christianity is vastly more beguiling than is Islam. And so I hold Paul speed to the fire for that. But you know, both were primarily opposed to Jews.
Oh, absolutely.
Paul's letters are hugely anti-Semitic. Both men were in all likelihood Jews. Muhammad was born in Yathrib to in a community that was three-quarters Jewish, abandoned by his mother and father, but he was in all likelihood Jewish, and Paul admits to being Jewish. So both and both men made as their primary enemy Jews. And it's interesting that both men came to hate Jews after receiving and corrupting their testimony. When the Jews then said, wait a minute, which you bought this or you've taken this from us and then you've twisted it. And they were in this best position to know that both Paul and Muhammad were lying. And those who were not ignorant of the Torah, who knew that Muhammad and Paul were lying, became the enemy of Paul and Muhammad. That's how his hatred of Jews began. They could prove that he was a liar. And so he had them hunted down and killed. Both of them.
So why does the Christian world, Western Europe and the United States primarily, or the British Empire or Commonwealth, why have they turned into such anti...
Well, they were born that way. Because Christianity, the religion of Christianity, Pauline Christianity, was born in wholesale opposition to Yahweh's chosen people. It is, they're opposed to Israel, they're opposed to Jerusalem, they're opposed to the Torah, they're opposed to Yahweh, they're opposed to Yahusha, they're opposed to Israelites, they're opposed to Yahudim. That is the nature of Pauline Christianity. It was in wholesale opposition to all those things, as was Rome, from which it emerged.
Right. Now, I may have misspoken, but what I was thinking is, why is the Christian world, is that why they're supporting the Muslims? I mean,
the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Yes, yeah. Shen Zhu's philosophy of the enemy of my enemy is my friend has been the immoral march of humankind for a very long time. And so, yes, they would find commonality with those who oppose Israel.
Now,
so, yes, I think to a large degree there is an accommodation for Islam, because Islam's primary argument isn't against Christians. That's its secondary argument. Its primary argument is against Jews.
Yehudim.
Yehudim, yeah.
Now, how did a generation, now I'm in my 60s, how did a generation that I grew up in, now granted I was overseas in Australia and so forth, but I was born in the South, and that whole generation pretty much could easily abandon war. I mean, went out and marched against the Vietnam War, went out and marched about everything. They quickly turned.
It's interesting. You're right. Let's pause here. Just one thing.
Sure.
The generation that grew up in the 60s, and I was part of that.
Uh-huh.
We ultimately came, almost all of us, to recognize that the Vietnam War was started on a lie, that it was unwinnable, that there was no way to justify the carnage and the loss of lives and the squandering of money, because there was no way to win, and there was no American national interest there, that we ought not be there. Almost the entire generation that lived through the 60s came to realize that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it's that very same people now that are embracing their military as we go off and fight new Vietnams.
Right. And the same thing with the civil rights movement. I mean, it didn't take very long to the Ku Klux Klan was dead, you know, and people said, you know, this ain't right. And of course, I didn't grow up that way. My father wouldn't allow, you know, he just didn't allow that sort of stuff, and he was big enough to whoop everybody in town, so it didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
But the simple fact of the matter was racism, I know there's always some racism, but really it is not part of the South in the sense, or America in the sense that it was a in the 60s and so forth. I mean, everybody kind of picked up on that real quick, and they understood, and they said, well, that's logical. This is wrong. We shouldn't be doing this sort of thing. So why is this group electing officials to do everything
wrong?
Wrong.
Ignorant. Stupid. Right, stupid. Well, you know, it's interesting that I was just thinking about, because I was asked by a Discovery Channel program to possibly do a segment with them, and one of the questions was, you know, what caused you to leave, because I grew up in Southern California, and go to Virginia. And the answer was that the race riots following Rodney King made living in Southern California dangerous. You know, it was, we had employees that were shot at. We had our Federal Express driver shot at and killed trying to deliver a package to us. And you had to go back and forth to your office with a gun. It was not safe to live in Southern California because of the animosity between the races, but it was almost all black animosity to whites. Yeah. And so we moved to the South, where, you know, we're told that racism still thrived.
Yeah,
right.
What we found in
Virginia is that not only did people get along, they respected one another. I mean, I never once in Virginia had the sense that I needed to walk to the other side of the street. As a matter of fact, if an African American family came towards me in Virginia, my natural inclination was to greet them. Was to speak with them, to chat with them, and I was never disappointed. Not once in Virginia did I meet a gang member or someone who was acting threatening. And so you're right. Our generation came to realize that. We embraced the truth. So why are we so lost when it comes to Islam?
Yeah. I get it. I can make a case why we are, but not logically. I don't understand why we can be so stupid. And even though you and IQ are bombarding these things, I don't think there's just enough people that hear it. You know, it's the trouble.
Agree.
They just because you cannot argue with that. You can't. You just won't adopt it.
Another great example.
Go join the army. I'm sorry.
Oh, or why a woman's group can speak out against the NFL on the Ray Rice act of domestic violence and not expose and condemn Islam, when rather than one victim and her just being cold-cocked, you've got hundreds of millions of victims either sexually mutilated or raped and physically abused and killed, some whipped to death.
Yeah.
And they're unwilling to speak out against Islam when it is the most sexist, dominant, violent religion in the world. Welcome back to Shattering Mystery. We're having a conversation with Kirk. Kirk, your point is interesting. You're saying that the generation that lived through the 60s, which would include you and myself, we came to realize that America's military was and politicians were acting inappropriately. As it relates to engaging America in foreign wars, and we rebelled against it.
Mm-hmm.
We came to realize that racism was wrong, and we changed and stood against it. And yet, that same generation now is empowered, and when the President of the United States says the Islamic State is not Islamic,
it shows a hell of a name,
single,
doesn't it?
Yeah, not a single person, not one, not a politician on either side of the aisle, not a single national spokesperson stood up and say, are you crazy?
Yeah.
Have you lost your ever-loving mind? You know, if you want to make a case for us to go to war against the Islamic State, for God's sake, don't tell us. Yeah, don't lie about who they are.
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to form an alliance with Muslims to go fight Muslims when you're denying the fact that any of them are Muslims? It's absolutely insane. How could you have more evidence that Islam is a terrorist dogma? I mean, I've read now 2 hours worth of quotes from the Quran of Hadith, and I've got another 5 hours that I could read, and I'll probably read more of them on Monday. But here's with all of this evidence saying that Islam is a terrorist dogma, a declaration of war against all humankind, and the President of the United States says that no God condones the murder of innocents, and that the Islamic State is unlike any group prior in its barbarism, and yet all of the evidence and all of the scripture evidence, both historic and scriptural,
yes,
is 100% contrary to what he said, and not a single person stands up and says, you know, if you're going to commit America to another war, why don't you at least tell the truth?
And if they get the Ottoman Empire, I mean...
oh, God. My goodness.
Why do they think it was?
Did they forget that in the first 100 years of the Islamic era,
yeah,
that Muhammad killed, Muhammad's and his henchmen, killed over 200 million people? I mean, what on earth are they smoking back there in Washington, D.C.?
Now, let me throw one more thing in, because unfortunately today I'm going to have to probably quit about the half hour. But preachers and rabbis who constantly are studying prophecy from the same sources, probably not the exact same sources, but different translations, but from they studied Daniel all my life, Daniel and Yashaya, Isaiah.
Right.
And in there, and I know this is a little bit rhetorical, but type of question, but I see Yahweh says that he's going to come in, and if you're correct, 150 million people, Muslims will attack Israel at some point. He's going to come down and swat them like a fly, and then go back to a party for 3 years. So that's not a big deal to him. But I'm telling you, what you also read when you read about the United States and Western Europe, but the United States in particular, and he goes through all the horrors that are going to befall us. What are these people? Are they just deaf and dumb?
It's a combination of two things. One is that most scholars don't study the prophets in Hebrew. And so they don't ever consider what the words actually mean. They just look at some horrible translation of them. And number two, their perspective is inconsistent with Yahweh's perspective, which means it's impossible for them to understand prophecy. But
the rabbis?
Yeah, you know, as it relates to the Magog War, you just look at the nations that will be engaged, and Yahweh tells us the nations that will be engaged. He describes the religion of submission, even uses Allah's name, talks about the terrorism as the primary tactic, even talks to us about where the war begins and how the war manifests itself. And he says some four times that they're going to flood into Israel after Israel sacrifices the West Bank and becomes narrow at the waist. And he speaks of this unstoppable flood of Islamic terrorists into Israel. And the number 150 million is not the number stated in the prophets. What Yah just said is this unstoppable flood. So what I did is I took the nations that Yah said are going to participate, and I divided them into fundamentalist Islamic, dominant Islamic nations where not to engage in jihad would get someone killed. And I predicted the percentage of Muslim boys and men that would engage, and you quickly come to the number is going to be right around 150 to 200 million. Kirk had to go. His question was really straightforward. And it is how, with all of the instructions and teachings and prophecies and insights that Yahweh has provided, have those Christians who are fixated on eschatology, on prophecy, not come to realize the inevitable, that America is an enemy of God, by God's own testimony, that Israel is still the only country on earth that God cares about, that God is going to protect Israel against Muslims, and then Muslims are going to attack Israel in great force, and so that if you are arming the Muslims and the Muslim nations, which America is doing to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars, then you literally are the enemy of God. With all of them looking at this material, how is it that they can't figure it out? It's the ultimate question that we have, Larry, on. And Larry, it seems so obvious, doesn't it? You really have to be in utter and complete denial yes, to miss it. And I'm assuming that the reason that the answer to Kirk's question is how did a generation that figure out that Vietnam was wrong, that racism is wrong, not figure out that Islam is wrong or that Christianity is wrong, is that they're unwilling to think if thinking requires them to abandon the religion of their youth.
Yeah, I had this debate about Paulos, he who is lowly and little. What a giant name for a guy that represents Yahweh.
Yeah.
I had this debate with a woman, and I showed her P46, which is extant.
Right.
It's the oldest wording we have from Paul's letters. And she says, "Oh no, you're confusing them." I said, "Well, how do I confuse a guy?" She was pro Torah, by the way. How do I confuse a guy who says he wants everybody under the Torah castrated?
Right.
I said, "Where am I wrong here?"
Right.
Then I showed her Yahweh talking about Paulos or Sheol in Chabawak. And I had that wrong. And then I showed her Yahusha saying that if any man comes to you and says, "I've been with him,"
he's a liar.
As a warning, I'm telling you this.
Right.
He could even fool you. He's a liar.
Right.
Now, then I was misquoting what he said. So I didn't understand Yahweh. I didn't understand Yahusha. And I didn't understand Paulos.
So there, in all of these cases, you're putting the person in her only rebuttal was, since she couldn't contradict the words of God, that you were misquoting him. She couldn't accept that Paulos was a liar, so you were misquoting him. She couldn't accept that Yahusha warned us about Paul, which he did many times. You don't have that right either. So they're by the way, did she have a what's right? Did she have an accurate translation of Chabaouk, where Yahweh says that Paul is the plague of death, and provides, not only does he condemn him by name, but he provides every possible clue. And there's at least 25 depictions of Paul, his time, his message, his audience, his strategy, that Yahweh condemns, in addition to condemning Paul by name. And all she can say is, "Oh, you're translating it wrong."
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure she holds on to the book named after the sun goddess Biblio, which you and I both know is a complete rewrite of Yahweh's words. I was amazed that not one ounce of it, not as much as an ounce of what
so,
I said.
So when Yahweh condemns Shaul and said this is a singular individual, and speaks of that individual's twisted soul, and talks about the attitude, the ego, and the
secular
claims.
Reasoning.
Oh yeah, this individual said that he's going to emerge and begin to corrupt people during the time the Moed are being fulfilled, which is when he was in Jerusalem learning to be a rabbi. That he was going to lay claim to Gentiles, which is Paul's greatest single claim, that he was going to be opposed to circumcision and yet still fascinated with male genitalia. He was a homosexual that was overtly opposed to circumcision. And that he was going to use this twisted circular reasoning, and that no one would be satisfied because he was the plague of death. And then he names him by name. What are we to make of that? Are we to believe
that misled people from all over the planet? Because it was many different people from many different races in many different places. And so that means he would be significant. He couldn't be some insignificant boob. We all know.
That's just like Yosha's statement in the Sermon on the Mount, where he talks about the wolf in sheep's clothing. That will direct people away from the Torah. It's like Yosha's statement about the false apostle of Ephesus. When he has the statement about when somebody claims that to have seen me, don't follow them. When you put all those things together, it's impossible that they would have even spoke of someone who is irrelevant. So it has to be the most relevant person who did these things, and there's only one person in all of human history.
Yeah, I know, and I even asked her, I said, can bad fruit come from a good tree? I said, because, you know, Yahusha said that can't happen. And I said, yet you're walking away from Christianity, and Christianity's framed with Paul's letters.
Right. Yeah, he's the author of half of the Christian New Testament. In fact,
it didn't happen.
When Paul wrote that the covenant that is presented in the Torah was with Hagar and therefore enslaves, how do you reconcile that if you understand the Torah? If you are pro-Torah, then you know that Hagar was expressly disassociated with the covenant, as was her son Ishmael, and that the covenant was formed with Yishak as the descendant of Sarah and Abraham exclusively without exception. And so how does one embrace Paul when he said exactly the opposite?
I mean, I have no clue. I mean, you'd have to just lose your marbles, wouldn't you? I mean,
you'd have to be you'd have to be unwilling to learn. You'd have to be unwilling to think. And you'd have to use what's called the ad hominem argument, which is what that woman used against you. When you can't refute the message, and in this case, she couldn't refute anything you said because you only quoted Yahweh and Yahusha. And since
you
can't refute them, what she did is she assassinated your character and say, no, you're the one who is misleading. You're not quoting them accurately, and yet she didn't have a correction for anything you said.
No, of course not. But I did ask her, I said, do you know of anyone who speaks for Yahweh that needs a historian? I mean, I don't know that Zachariah had one. I don't know that Yashayo had one. I don't know that Malachi had one. I don't even know that Manyahu had one. But I asked her because I said, you know, Luke was Paul's historian.
Right.
I said, does anyone that speaks for Yahweh need
a historian? Yeah, the Book of Acts was written as the history of Paul by Luke, Paul's historian. But anyway, you know, I just tried to read the Book of Luke. I read Matanyah and enjoyed it thoroughly. I read Mark and I enjoyed it less, but it was tolerable. Then I read Luke and I almost puked. It is so twisted, so incomplete, so utterly errant that you just say, how in the world did a religion emerge where the eyewitness Matanyah's testimony is obviously rejected in favor of Luke, who was not there? Luke didn't even have access to any of the eyewitnesses who were there. I mean, it's double hearsay. And he just got everything wrong. It's so twisted, so convoluted. It was nauseating as I continued to read through it. I had to stop. It just made me sick.
Well, it doesn't read like any of the witnesses.
No, of course. And if you try to read Acts, it is so internally contradictory. No, it's the most amazing thing is if you're trying to deal with Habakkuk, where Yahweh, 666 years to the year of Paul's first letter, 666 years in advance, denounces Shaul, Paul's given name, and he admits that his name is Shaul, and completely destroys everything that he had to say and the religion based upon this man. But it even goes so far as Yahweh was saying, why is it that you're unwilling to question him? Why is it that you're unwilling to question him? And what is Shaul name? What does it mean? What does the name mean?
Question him.
Yeah, I know.
It's a total bar.
Yeah, and
you know,
it's just so amazing. And for someone to say, no, he was talking about Sheol. Well, how does Sheol have a soul? Sheol's a place. Why would you question a place, Sheol? Why would Sheol, as a place, have a fixation on a group of people called Gentiles?
Well, he also says that this place slash man, Sheol, is a he, and it has a soul. Does Sheol have a soul?
Of course not. No, I mean, there is no way around it talking about Paul. You know, Sheol didn't emerge during the fulfillment of the Moed Mikra. The whole thing. Sheol didn't have a fixation as a place with a male genitalia. You know, Sheol most certainly doesn't have an issue with circumcision. Well, all of its inhabitants are uncircumcised. So, no, it's, you know, when Yahweh said that the sign of the covenant is circumcision. There's only one sign of the covenant. The sign of the covenant is circumcision. If you want to participate in the covenant, you will be circumcised of the spirit and of the flesh. And then he says in the prophet Ezekiel, if you will want to enter my home, you will be circumcised. And Paul's entire mantra is in opposition to circumcision. And somebody who is informed and logical can say that they're affirming one another, they're speaking for one another when they're saying exactly the opposite. That's moronic. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Larry, what you did is overkill. Now, I am guilty of overkill because I wrote a 1,200-page book called Questioning Paul. I did what Yahweh asked us to do, which was to question him, and wrote a 1,000-page book and drove 10,000 nails into Paul's coffin. But realistically, any one of these things in and of themselves, all by themselves, should have been sufficient. When Paul, in his second letter to the Corinthians, admits that he is demon-possessed, it's over. When Paul, in two of his letters, said that the fullness of the Godhead resides on him bodily, therefore promoting the pagan notion of the Trinity and that a man had become God, it's over. When Paul claimed that he saw his Jesus Christ on the road to Damascus when Yahusha said, if anyone claims to have seen me, they're lying, don't follow them.
He also said when he returned, everybody would see him.
Correct. He said it's over. When Yahweh claimed that Paul was the plague of death, it's over. I mean, when Yahusha said that the thing that, about Ephesus that I like is that you have not been beguiled by the false apostle. Well, there's only one person who claimed to be an apostle who wasn't. Paul. I mean, any one of these things all by themselves. When Paul spoke against circumcision, it's over. When Paul said that the covenant was in the Torah, was with Hagar and in slaves. That one line was sufficient to forever regale him to the world of deceivers and liars. When Paul said that the Torah cannot save, it's over. When Paul said that I am all things to all people, that I might prevail over all people, and that to the Jew I'm Jewish, to the Gentile I'm Gentile, to those who are Torah observant I'm Torah observant, although I'm really not, and to those who are Torah adverse I'm Torah adverse. The moment he said that, it was over. It's not trustworthy. When Paul admitted that he was murderous, it's over. When Paul said that it's a commandment in the Torah that says you shouldn't be a sexual pervert, of which there is no such commandment, caused him to be a sexual pervert. It's over. When Paul changed his name and came in his own name, Paulos, as opposed to Shaul, with an entirely different message, and Yahusha in the Sermon on the Mount said, I came in my Father's name, which is Yahusha, it means Yahweh saves, and you do not accept me, but another, he shall come in his own name, and he you will accept. It's over. You know, you don't need all of them. Any one of them is irrefutable. Collectively, it's just overkill. So well, what of the individual who can't process any of this? What do you say to that individual?
Well, I'll tell you what I did. I said, okay. Well, you're religious, and that's your mm-hmm. problem. She was, of course, advancing the notions of a group on FB called the 119 Ministries. They're all over the place if you ever read their stuff. It's almost laughable.
Okay.
You know, one of them.
119, that's not one of Yahweh's numbers, isn't it? Yeah, Yahweh's got the number 7, which he really thinks is important. But sometimes he uses 4 to talk about a time of a completion of a time of testing, or 40. And he uses 3 as the number representing family. But how many was this now?
119 ministries. You know, they all beg for money on each of their individual websites,
okay.
By the way.
All right. Okay. So
see, the problem they have with guys like you and me is that we don't have a religion to sell, and we're not worried about stepping on another religious person's toes.
Is there any place in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms that Yahweh asks for money?
No. He says it's all free. He says the opposite, actually.
Right. Does there any place in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms that Yahweh says, I'm establishing ministries?
No.
I mean, just no. Does Yahweh speak in first person in his Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, or does he have his prophets say, but I say?
He speaks first person, is what he does.
Yeah, you don't read in Yahshayah, instead of Yahweh said this, Yahweh said that. That's what you read. But can you imagine Yahshayah or Yirmiyah or Moshe saying, but I say? You know, God said this, but I say this. No. And yet, that's the dominant theme of Paul's letter. This is really not difficult. If your eyes are open, if your mind is open, it's obvious, folks.